like another artist like you. I mean, man, kids listen to that and they think they can do, they think they can, you know, they take that stuff to heart.
Yeah. Well, you remember back in the day, man, when It Takes a Nation of Millions, Public Enemy. Jesus, you had all ethnics buying up that stuff because it resonated. It was truth that resonated with everybody. And especially now, you see less of the political climate conversations going on within music. I mean, there's quite a few people on you know, just YouTube and stuff, few channels that I look at. And a lot of this, without getting too, you know, deep, dark side about it, but it's like a movement, which a lot of people are arguing is like a Hollywood takeover, Illuminati takeover of hip hop. And okay, some of it I subscribe to, some of it I don't. But the biggest point that they make that I think is really credible is the fact that it's now the message, you know, Professor Griff and stuff like that. They're saying, well, the message has been lost from hip hop. That movement has now turned into, you know, as you're saying, Lamborghinis, Rolexes, and all that stuff. So. I think that really and truly, you know, misery loves company. So it's easy to sit down and talk about how shit things are. And, it, you know, at the same time, try and have some kind of balance to, well, this was my headspace, have some kind of balance to, you know, a positive message. Okay, these are the problems. Well, what's the solution going to be? You know, what's the antidote to it? The antithesis then or whatever to it, you know? So. In that respect, you see a lot of guys not really doing that. Even when we were doing Money is Debt, as I sat down and wrote that, it's something that from how I went about it, was drawn from personal experiences. I mean, I go in there and say, you know, £3 over my overdraft, and that suddenly turns into 30, which was absolutely true because I was banking with Halifax, and I literally went over £3, you know, so... I was 2 years paying that off, man, because I refused. I thought, oh, I'm not paying you. And they just said, all right, then, well, checkmate, mofo. Listen, check this out. We're going to just keep taxing you until you buckle. So it turned into like a couple grand.
Yeah. Oh, I got a similar story. Mine would be roughly the same as yours, because mine was about $7, and I think the exchange rate is around the would be about the same, and mine was with Wells Fargo, and they're just like okay, well, that's $7, they tacked on $20 to it because of overdraft.
Then
it was just penalizing the crap out of me for stuff.
And then we act like we don't have to pay it, but you know. When it reached like crisis point and they were talking about bailiffs and we're going to really like get heavy with you now, I had to buckle and pay it. So in a way, the positive out of that was that it gave me fuel to write about, to hopefully show people that, yo, check this out. This is something like serious and we have to do something about these cartels. I mean, every time, you know, Obama, man, come on. When he got in, it was that thing where, don't get me wrong, I saw it was a brother in the house all of a sudden in the house, and I shed a tear, and they did him and Michelle did the dance, and I was like, oh man, it's the first time that we see, you know, a brother actually, we can be critical thinkers, we can lead countries, and so on and so forth, you know, but in the end, it's like, wait a minute now, I remember he was on, I can't remember when he was a senator, he went on one of the talk shows, if it was Letterman or Leno.
Yeah, he was a senator for Illinois from 2004 to when he was elected president.
Yeah. And I think it was Leno asked him, or it might have even been Conan O'Brien, I can't remember now, but one of them said to him, oh yeah, so look man, you know, what's the deal with that lapel pin? And he was like, yeah, you know, I'm never going to wear the lapel pin. But, you know, he's a puppet at the end of the day.
He's got it on now.
And he's blazing it, right?
Yep. Well, and if you notice, I mean, like, I was caught up in the Obama stuff, too, man. I mean, with me, it was like, you know, he seemed like he was going to go in there and just rip the system apart. You know, like he was going to go in there and he was going to expose people, and he was going to, and you know, with his healthcare plan, I thought, okay, you know, people, no matter, you know, people don't have to go to the hospital and worry about how much they're going to have to pay, anymore. I was thinking like that stuff's great, you know, but he's a continuation of Bush and Clinton and Reagan and, you know, because they get, and you can put Jesus in there, man, at this point, and like, and that they will be homogenized.
No doubt. What happens? And you know, the funny thing is, every single one of them that gets elected, they never, and this is the smoke and mirrors, because I, you know, Obamamania had me gripped, son, gripped, right? I mean, come on now. And Bush, it was such a sleight of hand, such a, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid, and basically, Bush, you get in there, and wait a minute, this guy's not even talking about the Federal Reserve. He steered clear of it to this day. And that seems to be always the benchmark, that you know a man who, no, if he was purple with pink polka dots, if he ain't talking about changing the Federal Reserve system, he's a puppet. And that's the bottom line, I think, you know. So I see this, that it's, you know, a responsibility almost to use this music to talk about these things, because it doesn't seem like people are willing to talk about it. It's funny you say that, man, because actually I just was dealing with the landlord, and then I just put a post up last night about Gaddafi and what's dude's name? Saddam. And I put this post up on Fuckface last night, and bosh, instantly, and the soundbite underneath there was like, yeah, man, like, actually, let me just pull that shit up. Hold on, sit tight, because it was a real debate, and to the point that I actually just spent, and I'm not bullshitting you, 3.5 hours today constructing a response back to the tirade, because I raised my head above the pulpit, or whatever they call that, and people were looking to take it off, clean off my shoulders. So I had to really kind of find the discourse, use the words that I've learned, the reads that I know, base my opinion in fact, and, you know, articulate myself in a way that gave my, because I tagged money as debt into the post as well. So not only was I saying that as Adrian, I was saying that as Official Burnt Toast. So in that respect, I really kind of stuck my neck out. Anyways, the post reads, you see a picture on the left of Gaddafi and a picture on the right of Saddam. And it says, what do both these men have in common? And then the caption underneath is, they refused to accept American dollars for oil, and their central banks were not owned by the Rothschild family. Well, that was instantly roasted, because I was putting up, i.e., allegedly anti-Semitic propaganda. So that was, you know, it's a big statement. And to say that looking at the obvious makes me anti-Semitic. So this is the Kool-Aid that most of the people have been drinking. Now, a few people, you know, music friends of mine and other friends of mine piped in as well. But to respond to that today, and I'm not bullshitting, I was 3.5-4 hours constructing. I'll just read you the first little bit there. And I said, to respond to one of the guys there, I said, I'm surprised at the simplistic narrative shouted from the rooftop, guy's name, James blah, blah, blah. The present geopolitical financial affairs cannot be distilled through one man or indeed one family. The dots are to be connected and the breadcrumbs followed before independent shouting. Looking at a battle and not the war remains part of the problem. Gaddafi was a battle. Saddam was a battle. To shift away from the petrodollar is the war. And I go on with, you know, that sort of that thing. But that took me ages to write that, man, because, you know, I had to think through every word and syllable I put out there. So hopefully the second album will be the same sort of thing. I just literally come up with, finished writing this next track called Octopropaganda Pussy.
Oh, and wow. I love your wordplay, man. I mean, it's just so next level.
Thanks, man. Listen, this track I come up with now, and I'm just writing I'm just coming up with a few little snippets of it now and finished it off. But the track was something that, you know, on the first record, I played all the drums and wrote the B-lines and stuff like that. But this one I would like to take in a bit more of a direction. Still less, there's a couple tracks on the first record that are about, you know, failed romances and standing in the queue and riding the bus. But I'd like to use this space to talk about more hard-hitting and in-your-face things. Not to get on a soapbox, but to continue, because I believe that it's our charge in this day and age, especially with this financial system the way it is, to say things of relevance, you know. So I can hardly wait to share that with the people, you know, Octa Propaganda, say, you know.
Well, you know what it is, man, the whole financial system, the only purpose of the financial system is to put a value on things and people.
Yeah. That's it.
Right? You know?
That's it. That's too right. And that's what I was trying to relay to. I had to do research, copy and paste things to support my argument, or just not even my argument, to illustrate the truths. Because, you know, because the guy's name is Rockefeller or Rothschilds or whatever, it doesn't mean that one is being anti-Semitic. Those are the facts, right? So.
Yeah.
The facts. I mean, the Federal Reserve works without checks and balances. And, you know, Ben Bernanke basically said, well, nobody can look into our vaults. We don't have to answer to anybody. So these things, people don't even realize it's a smoke and mirrors. I bet you if you ask a lot of, well, I can't say that. I bet you. I should ask you. Do you think if you asked people in America if they know what the Federal Reserve is, because the smoke and mirrors is the word federal, and reserve. So if you ask people in America, if Jammer Direct put a survey out, do you think that most people in America would realize that there are no reserves and it's not federal because they're not attached to the state?
It's no more federal than Federal Express.
Wait,
it's, nobody knows that, but you're right. It's a private company that sells money to the feds.
Right. Man, you know, in America, differently, and Canada to a certain extent, because in England it's not like that. You don't have the IRS and stuff, you know. I mean, you still got the tax man, and they're still deep and heavy. But I remember in Canada when, you know, I was born here but raised there, and I remember, you know, if you fucked around, man, like, people would come kick your door off with arms talking about the tax man. And I know that's doubly heavy. Canada's like Bud Light. And America's like Budweiser, you know what I mean? So you guys get it well heavy in that respect. So it's a bit like, wait a minute, if this is a private company, then, and they're not, you know, being held to any checks and balances, then surely, man, surely we as the people shouldn't have to. I mean, you don't pay your taxes, and some of the IRS has got a Glock kicking your door off, right? Talking about we're coming to collect. So,
and they'll take all your stuff with you too.
Do they?
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen them where they put boots on cars in the driveway. They'll start locking up your house or changing the locks and everything.
No way, man.
Yeah.
That's heck I thought. I can't believe it, you know. And that's, I think, a lot of people sleepwalk into these sorts of things because they don't realize that it's, as you say, but I can I use that? It's no more federal than, what'd you say?
Federal Express. Did you ever notice the logo? Their logo is designed to decept. I mean, it basically looks like a federal department logo.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's big time, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah.
And it's on all the U.S. money.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah. If you look on the side, it's like usually on the right side of the front, it'll say United States Federal Reserve. And, wow. You know, I mean, it'll be their seal. And the only, yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Companies don't use seals. Companies use logos. Government departments use seals. Like, you have the Department of Defense, you have the Department of the Interior, all that other stuff. So they're purposely deceiving people into thinking they are a part of, or a department of the federal government when they're not. They're a private company. They're a private company with one customer.
Yeah. Who's the one customer?
The federal government.
Wow.
Yeah, they are not part of the feds. I mean, the government pays them to make money, literally.
Yeah. So let me get this right. So your post Federal Post isn't it's a private company?
It is an individual company. Yeah, it is not a department of the government. United States government cannot make its own money. That is against the law.
Yeah. No, I meant the post people.
Oh, the post office?
Yeah.
Oh, no, they are part of the government.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But then, so how is it the post office is called? This is what I'm saying. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Federal Reserve, it's even right here on Google. The Federal Reserve is a bank. It's a private bank.
Therefore, not having to answer. It's been written in law that they don't have to answer to anybody. And no checks and balances. I mean, you know, hey, did you guys hear about the other day? Germany said, okay, we all know about Fort Knox, and after World War II, I guess America held on to various countries' gold and blah blah blah. Now, the other day, and I'm saying like a month ago, if that, Germany over here said, yeah, check this out, we want our gold back, and America said, we can't give you that back. I said, okay, we want 30% of that back. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I heard about that. They ended up pulling a Bernie Madoff on Germany is what they did.
No doubt.
You know, they're like, yeah, well, France has it.
Yeah. And they melted a bunch down, and because obviously Germany gold would have had a German seal on it. They couldn't produce all the gold, so they melted it back down, put some bogus thing on there, Federal Reserve stamp on it, and then gave half of what they requested back, which was a quarter of the entire lot. So, yeah, man, I mean, this is our charge to really expose these things, yeah. I think.
You want to hear something really weird? My dad was in the Army in the 60s. He was in the mm-hmm. Army in the 1960s, and he was stationed in Fort Knox for a few years. Not the Gold Reserve. Fort Knox, the original Fort Knox, is the Army base across the street from the Fed, from the Gold Reserve. But the Army gave them the Feds the land across the street so they could build that reserve, but the army base has nothing to do with it, but they're both called the same, you know. Mm-hmm. but they're across the street from each other. My dad used to tell me, he goes, man, what, like he had guard duty, like front guard duty, which means he had to sit in the front gate, the watchtower at the front gate, which faced the street and you could see the Federal Reserve. He said when he'd have guard duty, like third shift guard duty and stuff, he'd see semi trucks across the street, like company semi trucks that said, you know, like Kmart and, you know, and like Jack Daniels and stuff, across the street with the backs of the trucks facing the loading docks on the reserve. So he told me, he goes, I'll bet you there's not even gold there.
Yeah, this is what seems to be the case now.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So they don't let anybody in there either.
No doubt. So, the Germans went over there and said, we want to look. And they said, no, like, no, you can't. No. Here's three bars. And literally, no bullshit. They showed him like three bars and were like, this is just stupid. Nobody goes down there. Nobody, not even you, even though it's yours. Well, our policy is blah, blah, rah, rah. So it really is just like, whoa, man, I don't think people realize the state of, you know, where we're at. And if that buckles, what the consequence is. So I feel like we got but so much time to kind of, you know, get the message out there. So, yeah, I guess this is where you guys come in and help spreading the word and stuff. So, yeah, cool, man. It's much respect.
Definitely. Well, thank you, man. Well, it's guys like you, too, that make it, you know, that make it known through your lyrics.
Props, man. You remember back in the day, my mom and dad used to tell me that, you know, guys would try and get the stuff out, and they would take the records to DJs, and DJs would play that stuff, and nowadays there's no record shops, there's nowhere to do it. So you guys are at the vanguard of you know, getting it out there really, really and truly. So you think about, if it's you guys got it on your playlist and on rotation, well, that, how many people tune into that? And actually, you know, maybe even just if 10 people listen to it, one person says, yeah, all right, Let me think about that for a minute. Then, boy, job done, right? You know, so
exactly, yeah. Exactly. Well, not only that, but you know, you put it on SoundCloud and you know, and everywhere else on Facebook, YouTube, and you know, you'll have. I mean, pretty soon you've got millions of people that are listening to it and actually understand the lyrics and you know agree with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder, man. I'm fingers crossed, because that's the mission, you know. It's not even about the shekel; it's about the message. And I feel like, I don't know, a real personal charge, genuinely a personal charge that got to say something to help change the timbre of what's going on.
Yeah, I hear you there. And I mean, well, think about this: with the United States, it's getting even worse, you know, because now mm-hmm. now they're not even trying to hide, you know, the 1%, because now you've got Donald Trump against Hillary Clinton.
That's weird, right?
You know, it's like, man, you know,
how can someone get busted like literally like that with those emails and stuff?
Yeah,
and just walk. I don't get it, man. I don't get it. And Trump, he comes out with some. I mean, okay, he, you know, I don't want to draw any conclusions, but again, here's a guy who doesn't talk about the real issues, and that's the Federal Reserve printing money. But he has said, you know, this quantitative easing is an absolute Ponzi scheme, and he said things like that. But I haven't really seen any sort of, you know, concrete chirp against the Fed. You know, I haven't really seen any of that. So
exactly. Well, that would I think, you know, changing that even in the most minute detail, you mm-hmm. know, would almost or actually, you know, crush our monetary system. And it's not just the United States that would suffer from that. I mean, almost everybody at this point bases their monetary value on the US dollar.
That's right, man. That's right. Well, that's what this post I was saying was arguing, was the fact that Gaddafi and Saddam had their asses taken out because they didn't have a plan B. And they came off, shot their mouths off, talking about, well, fuck you, America. We're going to now have a gold. Well, in Saddam's case, he was like, I'm blowing the reserve out, the petrodollar out, and we're going to shift to euros. Well, bosh, bosh, plane flies into a building, and he's taken out. And Gaddafi, he was like, well, actually, we're going to make the African, I think it was called dinar, and bosh, bosh, he was taken out. So, you know, it's a dangerous game to even shake that, and at the end of the day, it's going to buckle.
Yeah. So, well, and here's the thing, too. I think what's going to happen in the next 10 years is the United States will no longer be a superpower. I think that's inevitable. And I'm actually, as an American, okay with that. I think that's fine. I think that, you know, to have other countries give an equal voice as what we're giving out and stuff, I think that's great. And I think the United States could perfectly survive that. Think about this. You're living in a country that is no longer a superpower. The United Kingdom was an empire for 300 years.
No doubt.
More than 300 years.
It was the sun never sets in the empire.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But look at, I mean, like after World War II, all empires just vanished, you know, and including the United Kingdom. And I think the United Kingdom's a better country for it.
Mm-hmm. You know what, man? I would have to say, because of that, what makes this island particularly special is the fact that they proactively, you know, I'm not really talking about the governmental systems and stuff. I'm saying about the subculture and culture that's made in this little island quite a special place in comparison, is that they proactively went after migrants from colonies to bring them over here to do the shitty menial jobs. But that in itself bred a subculture that, you know, you had the punks and you know, from that you had black and white people hanging out together and reggae and ska and
they desegregated themselves by default.
Right, exactly, man. You know, so that's what, there was a guy, Adrian Sherwood, he talks about that. He was asked something by an Australian interviewer, And he laid it out real, real sweet. I mean, Adrian Sherwood is a legend of the game, and he basically said, you know, he, because of the Jamaican sound systems and stuff like that, he cut his teeth in that particular genre, which gave him this unique voice. So, yeah, I think this island has been better for it in that respect because of the Empire buckling.
Yeah. You know? See, and I think I personally, I'm probably going to get a lot of crap for this, but I think the United States, if the U.S. went through the same thing, it's okay. And mm-hmm. it's, I think we're at a precipice right now because I know people that feel just like I do, like other Americans that feel just like I do about this country. And then I also know just as many people that would say, like, you know, like that would just hound you to death if they found out you know, let the flag touch the ground. You know, when in all actuality, the flag is not the country. The symbolism is not the country. The people are the country. And that's true with any country.
Yeah. I have to agree there, man. And that's particular. One thing I'm really grateful for being raised over on that side of the Atlantic is that, you know, in Canada and America, we're raised to believe that. I was heavily into motorsports when I was in Canada, you know, motocrossing and go-karts and all that stuff. And one of the things that we were, you know, raised to believe over there is that you can take this dirt bike and flip it 600 or 720 degrees, 360 degrees, backflip off of a 60-foot ramp and land it. And there's no way you can do stuff like that unless you're raised to believe that you can achieve those particular things. And that something in the water, something in the Kool-Aid, is that being raised over there gives us this inroad to this self-belief that if we can get the boot off our neck to be able to exercise that self-belief in the first place. But if we can, then, you know, that's one of the big differences between here and there from what I've noticed so far. And, you know, there's a different allowance to believe that you can be this particular thing, you know, so differently over there than that.
Exactly.
Again, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think over here, like in the United States, we're at that point where we look, like you said earlier, we look at the battles and not the war. You know, and we're so caught up on the small things at this point. It's not even funny. Like up to a few weeks ago, if it was in the news over there, the whole Kim Davis debacle. She was a Kentucky court clerk, and when Kentucky made gay marriage legal, she refused to sign any of the marriage licenses, and then she went to jail. That stuff's just window dressing. I mean, that to me just says, okay, she's up for election next month. She's just going to get voted out.
Yeah.
You know, all you got to do is wait a few months. You know, yeah. I mean, like, that's all just little stuff. But, like, we ignore what I think are the big things. Like, well, like, marijuana is becoming legal state by state here. It's inevitable that at some point in the next 20 years, marijuana will be legalized in the United States. But here's the thing. There are still tens of thousands of people incarcerated right now for marijuana possession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, okay.
Have you ever seen that documentary by the guy who wrote that series, The Wire? And it was called The House I Live In. Man, oh my days. It was amazing, that documentary, because it illustrated how many brothers are in lockdown, especially brothers, I should say, are in lockdown for stupid misdemeanors like, i.e. weed. And it's just mind-boggling. And then sure enough, this guy, what he does is exposes that, just like the military complex, the prison system is a big money business, right? Deep stuff, man. Just makes you think to yourself, like, what? But, you know, this is, I gotta keep saying it, this is the stuff that we're supposed to be writing about, I believe. That's my personal opinion, is that that's the kind of stuff we're supposed to be exposing. What do you mean all the 75% of the brothers are in jail or are on some bullshit misdemeanor because of being locked down for, you know, stupid shit? It's and then we get to find out that people, you know, places are building prisons and then looking for people to fill them because they get a particular percentage per head. You know, that stuff needs to come out, and no one wants to stand on a soapbox and do it. So let's let the music be that form, like it was in the 60s. You know, I listen to John Coltrane. I love my jazz. You know, I really love my jazz. Blue Note was like Black History for me. You know what I mean? And you know, at the same time, alongside of my rock, Zeppelin and all that stuff too, but that was definitely where I was, you know, connecting with the most. And you listen to, even without the vocals, you listen to John Coltrane's track, Alabama. And if you can't hear the social struggle come through that horn depicting the time frame that he was recording that in, then I don't know what to say. You know what I mean? Like, that's the meat and potatoes of what yesterday was giving us, that kind of food. And it's not to say we don't have struggle nowadays. Okay, it's a very different thing. Racism has now become covert instead of overt, you know, because we're so PC correct, but that don't mean it's not there. You know, there's plenty to be talking about, plenty to be talking about beyond the plasma TV, the Lamborghini, the Rolly, the Chardonnay and all that stuff like that. Well, I'm even saying it to downtown because I don't even know what uptown is. It's not Chardonnay, it's something else. But you know what I mean? So this is the difference, but it's not that far off of what yesterday.
No. Well, you know, what you're talking about is really prophetic. I mean, another example I was thinking about with prison, you know, penalizing people, sending them to prison for commission. If you remember, I don't know if you saw it over there or not, but we had a thing called the Kids for Cash scandal. I don't know if you ever heard of that. Kids for Cash were two judges that got the state of Pennsylvania, that from the state of Pennsylvania. They were contacted by a privatized company or private company that just built a youth facility, which is basically a kiddie prison. And they got kickbacks for every kid they sent there. They said, what? Yeah, they sent one of the judges, what was his name? Mark Silveria or
Wait. I gotta get a pen.
Okay.
Hold on. Okay, what? All right, I'm back. Kids for Cash?
Kids for Cash scandal. One of the judges was named Mark Ciavarella or something like that. And then there was another judge, Michael Conahan. And they prosecuted kids and sent them to jail sent them to prison for years on things as minute as one kid mocked his principal on MySpace, like just made fun of him, like just called him fatty and stuff and all this just minute stuff. And he got like 3 years.
No way.
I'm dead serious.
You remember back in the day it was called Juvie Hall?
Yeah.
So what you're saying, this is the upgrade now.
It was it wasn't a federal prison. It was a private prison for children, you know, 13 to 18.
Oh, shit. I'm just going to do a little bit of research.
It's called the Kids for Cash scandal. And what it was, there are privatized prisons here in the United States. And what happens is if a judge sends somebody to that prison, that company bills the government.
Right.
And that's how, So
that's deep. I can't believe
One of the kids killed himself.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, you want to hear some evidence? Go on YouTube and do Kids for Cash scandal. One of the mother of the child that killed himself, who I think was like, I mean, I think what he did was like literally just jaywalking, you know, like crossing the street the wrong way, and he got a ticket, and then he got like, you know, like the judge sent him for like 2 or 3 years you know, fed, yeah. you know, to the pen and all that. And he committed suicide in the prison. And the mom, there's a video on YouTube of the mom confronting that judge because the judges got indicted and they got sent to prison.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the judges got like 55 years or something.
Oh, so so in that instance, he was exposed, but this is like endemic to the system.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at it on Wikipedia. It says on August 10th, 2015, just a few months ago, the federal judge that was presiding over this case awarded almost a $5 million settlement. To the families, get this because of the education of at least 2,400 juveniles that were wrongly sentenced.
Shock fucking factor. And like so it's like I said, so I just touched on something that was really and truly I didn't even know
the scale. Yeah, as a matter of fact, the two judges are in prison now. Cialavera is scheduled for release in 2035, and then Conahan is scheduled for release in 2026.
Yeah.
They're also barred for life from practicing law in any capacity.
Really? So you reckon, though, that these guys are patsies for a bigger picture, though, really? Oh, shit, man. All right, I'm... Well, there's some food to dine on right there. I'll be looking into that because this is the stuff, man. This is the stuff that needs to be spoken about. And you know, what better place to do it? Like I said, it used to be that music was the forum to do these things. I mean, like, you know, I don't know if he's what you could call it, political artistry or something. Yeah. I don't know. But
also, these kids were fed the minimum nutritional value, which means they were given 1,300 calories a day. Jesus. And then they were also left alone. Some of them wore the same clothes every day for the entire sentence.
Shock.
So yeah. So imagine wearing the same shit you've got on right now up till this time next year.
No, I can't.
Yeah.
Have to get head around it.
That whole place. I'll bet you that whole building smelled funky.
No doubt. Can you imagine? Mm. And those are kids, right?
Yeah.
With families.
That's in their raising years. What happens to them when they're kids is going to reflect how they are as people.
They're released from that system now and wash right back in there. Shock, man. This is what I'm saying. This is the stuff now that needs to come out.
Get this. Like they were all minute cases. Like you got the guy mocking a principal on MySpace. He had another one was one kid trespassed through a vacant lot. One got caught shoplifting a DVD from Walmart, and they all got years.
Holy fuck! Can you imagine that? I remember when I was a little guy, man. I fucking ended up stealing some like Matchbox bullshit car from Zellers. Yeah. And I can't imagine getting caught and then somebody saying to my mom and dad, yeah, and he just got 3 years for that, you know?
Yeah, like making fun of the principal. I used to make fun of everybody when I was a kid. I was like a massive shit talker when I was 13, man. I mean, like, you know, I was the one people went to, like, oh, yeah, so-and-so's fucking with me. Can you think of a comeback? I remember like, oh yeah, yeah, you know, I mean, telling people stuff like that. Oh yeah, just tell him that, you know, his mom's a whore and he came out his ass because her pussy was busy.
Yeah.
You know? There, go say that. But like, I mean, like, yeah, if I got years for that, I would come out the most quiet motherfucker you ever met.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But eventually holding some kind of gun, eventually, surely, right? And turn that on somebody.
Oh, yeah, because when you get busted for that stuff and then you get treated like shit for years and years and years, man, that's you're going to come out of fucked up.
Yeah, yeah, looking to blame. Hey, hold on a minute. Yeah, can you hear me still? Yeah, yeah, looking to blame and everybody's guilty. Yeah, dude, I know the situation and the deal. It's like, I can't imagine it. I can't imagine this country. One thing I gotta say is that right now we see, I mean, you see more isolated incidents than over there. But not to say it's not happening here, you know. This is the illusion. It's going on, not to that same extent. But I tell you what, man, it's a bit more insidious, a bit more clever. Stop and search, it's called, and things like that. You know, racial profiling, all that's still going on. All of it's still going on. You know, one of the tracks I wrote was about, you know, touched on the riots here because we had this guy shot. And did you get a chance to listen to What You Gonna Do or What's in a Word?
No.
Okay, listen, man. When these tracks there, they're basically talking about, like, what you gonna do when I wheel up on you, tired of non-threatening to get me through, frustrations in my heart when I look at you that I can't share, eat me up inside like warfare, beware. And this is a lyric that I picked out because really and truly, you know, it's this thing where you just get fed up of, like I say, it's a little bit more insidious, creeper here, not so overt. And it's the, your brother's walking down the street and people cross the street, or here you've got the famous English black cab. And, you know, when I first moved back here, you couldn't get a cab if you were a brother. Me coming from Canada or raised here, raised there and coming back here. You know, I was like, what the fuck, man? These people won't pick me up in the fucking cab. Only to then, you know, oh, shit. You know, overall wearing, or they call them dungarees here, dungaree wearing mofo. You know, just naive, man, naive. When I first moved back here, there was like gollywogs on jam jars and shit. So it's still like, it's a different creeper, but that doesn't make it any less relevant. Anyways, man, a couple summers ago, a brother was shot in Tottenham. And this brother in Tottenham now, he basically was mowed down. And it turns out that he didn't even have a weapon. But they mowed this brother down. And anyways, people took to the streets, man, burned the place down, And I was living in the neighborhood when it happened. So, you know, What You're Gonna Do is partly inspired by my own personal experience and partly inspired by the marginalization that we feel here. And differently here, the brothers here don't have the same voice as the Americans do, because it's just, you know, a bit more get in line and don't speak out. You know, I was raised in Canada, and if you went to a restaurant and you were served cold food, you would say, hey, man, my food is cold. I want a next plate. But here, with the English etiquette and sensibility, people think twice about that. I'm not saying they don't do it, but they think twice about being seen to complain. You know what I mean? And so if your food is cold, then you're kind of complaining.
Because they
kind of
look at it as being uppity, maybe.
No doubt. You remember those words, right? Mm-hmm. So exactly it, and it's actually refreshing to hear that word, because I haven't heard it, and people don't use it here, but that's exactly what it is. It's we can use that framework to describe it being seen as uppity, and because there's two different kinds of stamps here, you know, first class and second class, you know, you got to get in where you fit in, and, you know, you're assigned a station, which that might be first class or second class, middle class, you know what I mean? It stratas into all kinds of different tiers. Track I wrote, What's in a Word, you know, I took some time out to study sociology and cultural studies, because I was asking myself questions, man. Like, before I wrote this record, I was touring. I left Canada to come over here to follow music as a drummer, and, you know, got my chops together and whatnot, and loaded my AOT drums up on the plane and came and stuffed all my clothes in the drums and showed up here. I hadn't seen my cousin in 15 years. She knocked on his door. I'm like, I'm your cousin, and can I stay here? So he was like, what? Okay. So, you know, dropped in, and, you know, I took the time out because I had to ask myself some serious questions. I thought, fuck, am I doing music because it's the only thing I can do, or am I doing music because it's what I want to do? And I couldn't really answer that question, but I started feeling guilty coming home at 4, 5, 6 in the morning after gigging and seeing people going off to quote-unquote normal jobs. And that's what started playing in my mind because, you know, Mom and Pa had instilled the "you're a lazy bum if you're not working" type vibe in my head. So took the time out to study at a uni here, Goldsmiths, and, you know, to answer that question for myself. Anyways, man, you know, redonkulous taking on that debt, but it was brain food. And I used some of those, lyrics, some of those knowledges that I got, you know, from that study of sociology and cultural studies to write lyrics. And, you know, like "what's in a word" is particular, you know, just a minute, let me think of, "what's in a word, is it the way it is heard, meaning and man tied up in a plan, flat and sharp keys like my mood, feeling behind the eight ball and a certain side of the moon, you know, not inside, not in jail for having something over you when I hail, the count goes bust but not on a list," you know, and just talking about the phrase of how comes everything negative is black, is dark, you know what I mean?
So, exactly. Even in fiction, I mean, like the white hat versus the black hat.
No doubt. It, just 2 seconds, right? Hold on a minute. I'll say, let me just get a lyric there for you. Just a minute. All right, man, I'm back. So just basically, you know, the couple of writers that I had really liked when I was studying gave me some inspiration. Guys like Stuart Hall, W.E.B. Du Bois, there's a few, you know, Paul Gilroy's name is, Stuart Hall just passed recently. He's a legend of the game, that guy, man. Absolute. Now these are black British Caribbean guys that were instrumental in giving me another perspective of who I am beyond jazz history. You understand what I'm saying? So it was kind of like, let me just see if I can. Let me see. Yeah, colorblind. Can you hear me? Yeah, all right. So one of the things was, colorblindness can be strategically effective only if it sees what it pretends not to. What can we use to describe words that collide like interracial relationships? Words draw crowds at the same time. Negativity attached to darkness in me. What's in the word? Is it the way it is heard? Meaning a man tied up in plan. Flat and sharp keys like my mood, feeling behind the eight ball, because eight ball is black, and a certain side of the moon, dark side of the moon. Not in jail for having something over you when I hail, blackmail. Account goes bust but not on list, blacklisted. Sheep in the family, the one that wouldn't go miss, black sheep. Fist kiss that wouldn't exist, Black Panther move it. Wrist bound around, locked in words and sound. Chalk learned and wiped down the blackboard. Chopped into lexicons and boiled down. Adjectives become a noun. So this is all this kind of jargon that I got from taking that time out to answer the question if I'm doing music because it's the only thing I can do or because I'm doing it because I love it and that's what I want to do. You with me? So that sort of... is another angle in the second record that I want to also explore and look at because it's important that.
Oh, I was just gonna say I've got one for you. A million voices or a million meaningless voices. White noise.
Yeah,
because I always use that phrase "white noise" when there's like so much in a certain musical genre that. You know, it's become bland.
Yeah. And this is it, is that even a small thing, like if it's still negative, but it's a white lie. And, you know, let's not confuse the people with the phrases, because whether you're black, white, pink or purple, we all have the same, you know, trigger mechanisms going off in our head. And it's not about the individual, it's about the social programming. That's the key point, you know what I mean? To be hating on white people and stuff is, I'm not down. But let's look at the conditioning. let's look at the conditioning of the phraseologies that we use every day. You know, I'm in a group of people and they're talking about rah, 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 this, that, the other thing, and blackmail. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I know what you're talking about, but you could also be talking about me type shit, you know? So it's that kind of depth that track was trying to convey. That there's that sort of thing that track was trying to convey. And really and truly, you know, how to get out of it now. That's the second record needs to answer questions around how to move away. The first record was about illustrating the problems, and the second record needs to be about how to move away from these particular, you know, Pavlov's dog kind of conditioned response.
Ding! Yeah, yeah, change your thought.
Yeah, you know.
You know what? You know what? This is great because you're actually starting to remind me of my grandfather. Whose name is actually Benjamin Franklin Martin of all things, but you know, here's the thing. He used to own a drugstore / ice cream parlor. Like, remember back in the '40s, fifties, and sixties, like they would, like drugstores would have stuff like ice cream parlors where you can get like a float or a chocolate malt or something. But here's the thing: it was downtown, and he used to have these four kids come in. And they grew up together, and it was two of them were white and two of them were black, and this was back in the 40s. This was like right after World War II and stuff, and and they're probably about 9-10 years old, and they call themselves the Four Musketeers. I don't remember what he told me their names were or anything, but he started becoming one of the group, even though he's like 40 years older than them. But like they'll start talking about football and baseball and movies and stuff, and so he would start like let them try out the new flavors. When you get new flavors, and you get these wooden spoons out and stuff, and and they'd critique it for him, like, oh, this one's nasty, this one's great, you know, and all that stuff. But he started getting his friends who were other 40-year-olds, you know, saying, well, why are you letting those two black kids in? You know, yeah, and all that, they're harassing those two white kids and stuff. And so he put a big sign on the front of his drugstore. It's, you know, that says, you know, the only color barrier or something like that, that this establishment is concerned with is the color is green, and it shows a dollar below it. Nice. You know, it's like, you know, yeah, and yeah. He's like those are the Four Musketeers, man. He's you know, like they made his day when they came in, because they'd have all these really nice conversations, and you know, and they'd buy stuff and stuff, but then he'd hook them up with some extra stuff, and like, you know, he told me he was a little racist up until then.
Yeah, up until then,
like he knew, like he didn't know any black people up until then. Until he joined the army, he knew some, but they were segregated because the army was segregated back then. So they were doing the labor and stuff while he was learning how to shoot a gun, you know, stuff. But you know, like after he met those four kids, and they were in the poor section of town, because his store was in the poor section of town, and you know, but here's the thing. He started getting more money for his business, you know, because the other places on that whole street are like, we don't want them here and all this stuff. So, like, he became like a desegregated by de facto establishment, not even saying anything. You know, because those kids are all talking, oh, you ought to check out his chocolate malts, man, he's got some awesome, they started advertising for him, just talking about it,
right, you know, because of being accepted, because of being allowed to be in there. Listen, and that's the progressive
because those two kids told their two groups, you know,
that's the key right there.
Yep. Because those four kids told both of their groups and so on, and their groups and their groups and their groups and their groups and stuff, because those four kids were probably the catalyst, because it was two white kids and two black kids, all financially in the same boat. Their families are all on the same street. So they all know one another, you know? No doubt. And so, but then you get two different you know, to, you know, you get desegregated by, you know, by default, because all of, because their groups talk to their groups and their groups talk to, and so, and it just keeps going back. And then he said his business was literally 50-50 white black after that.
Yeah. See, and this is why I'm saying that this is the thing that, man, race is a fucking social construct, right? It's a fucking social construct. Let's just keep it real. And at the end of the day, you know, you look at this shit and you think to yourself, no, don't get me wrong, man. I'm saying, like, yeah, it's a social construct. That doesn't demean it, and it's not real. You know, it's very fucking real when I can't get a cab and I'm freezing my balls off. You know, it's realer than real. But at the same time, it's that sort of openness of the individuals who break down the social construct, because it is just a social construct. It's those kids, that two black kids, two white kids that are hanging together, that it's two black kids, two white kids, that two of them are rude boys and two of them are teddy boys, but yet they're listening to ska, and from ska you get punk, you know. So it's this kind of stuff that you look at and you think to yourself, yeah, that's the progress. That's the progression. But you don't make the progression unless you're willing to engage in the tough conversations and use this forum, music, arts, culture, to break down these constructs, man. And, you know, writing around this stuff makes me look at it. You know, one of the things that I was shocked when I got into Blue Note Records, man, I looked at it. And I was blown away at the fact that Francis Lyon and Alfred Wolf, I think his name was, were the two brothers. They were Jews that started up Blue Note Records. Why? Because none of the brothers could actually get a recording deal. And, you know, if it wasn't for them allowing the brothers to come in there and actually cutting profits back to the people that were making the music differently, the exploitative nature of where it was coming from in the first place, then we wouldn't have had Blue Note Records. We wouldn't have had people playing together. We wouldn't have had, you know, black and white band members in jazz because of these guys breaking down in the 60s and stuff, these social problems, right? So this is what we still have to, even though it's 2015, it's still a problem. It's still an issue. Yeah, man, okay. You still get, you know, racism. It's alive and well. Let's keep it real. But at the end of the day, differently, you now have a cross-pollination that's well entrenched and is not going anywhere. You know what I mean? And that's what we need to build it on in that respect. Looking at these terminologies and these phrases, like, you know, everything fucking negative is black and everything good is white, or in using it, these paradigms to illustrate left and right. It's bullshit. It's absolute bollocks, man. It's absolute fucking bollocks.
Exactly. So, exactly. And what I always find refreshing, though, is there's more and more people, and it's usually like the younger of the generation, that they're just oblivious to it. You know, like going back to those four kids, one of the things I remember my grandpa saying was they never had enough money for four Cokes. You know, so they would get one Coke and then they would just pass it back and forth between the four of them.
No doubt.
You know, so I'd be like, you know, like serious, like people who are racist would think that was gross.
No doubt. That's a learned thing. That's a learned thing, man. Because of these phrases and this social marginalization, that's a learned thing. And so, you know, it's this sort of charge that I'm looking at to really, you know, get my head around and keep writing about stuff like that. And, you know, you see it still. Thank God for social media, because that's allowing us to actually have a voice to expose the institutionally racist. You know, that's key. That's super key. I just saw this post the other day, and you know, it was about a brother being shot in America, and had it not been for the person filming that particular thing, you know, using the power of the social media, then that person would never have been brought to justice. And the irony is that it was a white person filming that particular incident. So it makes you realize that, yeah, we have come a long, long, long way since, you know, the Rosa Parks and all that stuff.
We've come a long way in some ways, but not in others. Because, like, I remember when Obama was running for the first term, you know, and then people start using his middle name, you know, and try to associate him with Islam. You know. And then all of a sudden, well, his dad's not an American, but you know, I'll bet he was born over there, you know, by over there. I don't think they meant Africa. I think they meant not here.
Yeah.
You know,
otherness. Yeah.
Yeah. That country called not here. He was, I mean, you know, it's funny. I mean, I knew people personally that would say that. And I'm like, dude, he was born in Hawaii. Case closed. He is an American. I mean, like, both your parents could be from Russia or Japan, and if they give birth to you here, you're an American. That's it.
No doubt. Full stop. Unequivocally so. And this is the thing that the youth today, however complacent, they seem to understand differently than the old school, right? So this is, you know, it's up to us to keep spreading the word, to keep showing direction and keep tearing down those old constructs, because they're alive and well. That's what's lingering and holding us back, is that those old constructs from back in the day are still there.
Yeah. You
know, they're still there.
Well, they're generational, and we just need to break that, because they're passed down from our parents and their parents and their parents' parents and all that. Yep. I always have a quick comeback for people that say stuff like that, like, oh well, you know, they're not born here, they're not from here and stuff. Like, well, you know what? What tribe are you from, Pocahontas?
You know
what I mean? You know? I mean, like, because they were the first ones here. So
this is where Canada, America, Australia, South Africa, I could go on, forget that we are guests in those particular places, yet we have the righteousness to say, yeah, that we are those places. And fuck me, man, it's not quite like that. Hey, hold tight, just 2 seconds, okay? Nice one, man, thanks, sorry.
That's no problem. Yeah. Oh, that's the problem. I'm gonna use this whole conversation for the interview, man. Fuck it. This is great. I mean, if that's cool with you, I mean, like, yeah, I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, because we're talking about some deep subjects, and I think in the case of Official Burnt Toast, like with your band, I mean, I think like that is perfect for this, because you're explaining the music better than we could have if you talked about the music.
Yeah. You know, I went to a drum lesson once, and I, the whole time I played drums, I had two lessons, and both of those lessons stand out to me, because, you know, what you're saying there, it reminded me of that just now, because, you know, I went to this guy's place in Vancouver, and Buff Allen, he was a well-known West Coast jazz drummer in Vancouver, and I Buff's place for like 2 plus hours. And the lesson for half an hour was $35, and I ended up staying there for like 2 plus hours. And Buff and I didn't sit on the drums once. Not once. We didn't pick up drumsticks. And it was the best lesson I've ever had in my life, because we talked about music, we talked about feel, we talked, you know, everything but sit down and play. And that guy, man, I'll never forget him. Never forget that guy. You know, so we don't have to talk directly about the record to be talking about the record. You know what
exactly,
I mean?
Exactly. I mean, I just think, you know, lyrically, what you're doing is so superior to what others are doing at this point, lyrically and musically. But the cool thing is your music keeps up with it. You know,
hopefully. Yeah, thanks, man.
I think so. I think what you've got going on is you're not doing it one-sided, where okay, the lyrics are deep and powerful, and then okay, let's spend 5 minutes on the music. No, you're not doing that. You're piecing it together, you know, one syllable at a time and one note at a time, and you can't top that.
Well, you know, when I sat down, I was on tour with this guy, Fink, and Dish Dunes, and we were at the North Sea Jazz Festival, and I sat down on the drums, and, you know, we're halfway through this tour or whatever, and I just started doing some spoken word from off the drums, and it was him that said to me, you know what, man, you need to stop drum teching, and really and truly, you need to stop being a sideman all the time, and you need to do your own shit now. And, you know, write your own record, because it sounds like you got a few things to say. And he was the one that kind of gave me the license, the permission, the belief in myself. I was, you think so? And so we talked about the name and, you know, back in the day, my mom and dad used to say that the reggae albums, like I grew up on Studio One, through my mom and dad and stuff, you know, Big Style and Soul, you know, my Fats Domino and my Archie Bell and the Drells and all that stuff as well. But, you know, it was them that showed me that those guys back in the day were toasting. So when I was on tour with Fink, it was like, well, you know, he said, you should come up with something that reflects what you're doing. And I said, well, spoken word. He said, nah, man, it's just, what did you grow up with? And I said, well, toasting. And he said, well, that's the name, isn't it, right there? So I kind of added the burnt on it because it was like, well, I guess because I'm brown, then, you know, I guess that makes sense, right? I guess that makes sense. And that's how the name came about. That's how the name came about, 2008, off of 2009, off the back of a tour. So, you know, I think that what makes this record was always going to be a calling card as opposed to the hit sensation. But, you know, what I feel most proud about this record isn't even the music or the lyrics, is the fact that I wrote it from a really honest place. You know, that was the thing I feel most proud about, is that I was 110% myself and genuinely doing it because I love it, not looking at any shekel, any kickback. It was just about, this is what I got to say, you know? So,
and you don't get more honest than that, you know? Well, you don't, it comes through, it you know, it comes through gold. I mean, it, you know, you don't get more honest with what, you know, with what you're doing. I mean, my hat's off to you, man. I mean, you got to tap straight from your mind to your soul.
yeah. It is the closest conversation I think I'll ever get with God is playing music. I really think that's about as close as I'm ever going to get next to death. So, you know, or an amazing orgasm, I don't know. But either way, they live in the same place, you know what I mean? It's the same, creativity comes from the same place. So I do look at it, man. I do think to myself, like, well, this next one, let's keep more of the same and introduce a few more elements into this, and still through an organic process. You know, one of the key ingredients that having this band, one of the key things, and again, this harks back to doing the sociology and cultural studies BA, was that it was really important to have diversity within the band. Like a couple guys now that are in the band as well, you know, I've known for, fuck, I guess I've known, I worked at a drum shop in Denmark Street, a famous street in London. And, you know, started playing, more kind of heavy hitting drums because of the bass player, Abs. Well, his name is Abrar Haviz. I call him the general because he wears this hat in one of his Facebook pictures, this wicked, like, old school hat, you know, military hat. And so I called him General Haviz, but, you know, he was the one that kind of helped me get back into, you know, playing the two and the four and a bit more rock and hard-hitting stuff. He used to play in an old band called Sona Farik, and they were signed back in the day to Sony and whatnot. Great record, you know, for the listeners. Check that out. And Pat, again, I've known Abs now, fuck, going on 10 years, and Pat, I've known him. He's a producer/bass player. You know, I guess I've known him, man, 15 years. So it was always really important to have a cultural diversity. You know, I got a white guy, Asian guy, me as a brother. Now, the last ingredient, if it's, I don't know how it's going to come about. I'm not forcing it in there. So, but I'd like to have a gender representation. If we ever do get a drummer, because right now with the two bass players and the backing track, okay, there's a balance there. Culturally and sonically, there's a balance there. But if I do ever switch it up and have a drummer, then I'd like to have a female drummer. I think that would be the ultimate, the final ingredient that would add a harmony to the band that is beyond, I don't know, what I could ever hope for or describe, you know? So I'm not forcing that one. I'm just letting that one kind of happen.